Okay,
content.
Hugh, ignore everyone. When you say that you have an original idea, that you should ignore everyone, please explain it, because I thought you should share an idea with everybody.
It's well, you can share it, but the thing is, the more kind of original your idea is, the less people are actually going to give you any good advice on it, and their advice might be helpful, but it's actually not going to help you too much, I don't think. Chapter two or chapter three, I always say, good ideas have lonely childhoods, if that makes any sense.
Go ahead.
Well, just all my good ideas, I tell my friends, I tell my family, they all think I'm nuts. And then 3 years later, I prove them wrong. And now I just don't tell them my ideas anymore. I just get on with it.
Well, you know, I really like that, and I believe in that, because we tell our students that, you know, if you do have a good idea, and we're all about coming out with an idea and licensing an idea to a company, but if you get advice from people that don't know anything about it, you know, they're going to give you bad advice. They don't know.
No, and also, there's a kind of social dynamic going on where they're used to you in a certain kind of social dynamic, a certain kind of power structure, either subservient or the opposite of subservient, dominant, and they're happy with that relationship. You have a really good idea, that's going to change their dynamic with you, because it'll change yourself and change your social dynamic. And so people don't like the power relationships, or they don't like the power equations being shifted without their permission.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of kind of cultural resistance, and that works not just with your peers and with your friends, but I mean, it works within companies and everything. The last, if you have a really good idea, and let's say you're working in a big company, let's say you have this really fantastic idea, but it's going to make your boss seem less relevant to the company, he's going to resist it. It has nothing to do with the merits of the idea. So,
mm-hmm. No, you're. I think you're absolutely right.
I think you just have to soldier on. And human beings are, we have this idea that ideas have some kind of objective merit out there, and they don't. It's all about human relationships.
Okay.
And no one can tell you whether your idea is good or not at the very beginning. All you have is kind of wee voice that tells you it is. And so, like I said, you just soldier on, and and the approval, disapproval by somebody, well, how much is that really going to affect the idea? How much,
Correct.
So,
Hugh, tell me this, and I believe this as well. You say that you don't really need a big idea, but it needs to be yours, and I believe that as well. What do you mean by that? It needs to be yours. It doesn't necessarily have to be a big idea to be successful.
Well, it's, it's kind of funny when you're in college, like going to business school, everybody wants to be the next Bill Gates or the next whoever, Slim Pickens, or not Slim Pickens, the other guy, the other rich guy. Everybody wants to be bigger than God or a movie star.
Okay.
And that might not be right for you. I mean, I wouldn't want to work as hard as Michael Dell, would you? You know what I'm saying? I wouldn't want to have to spend all my time worrying about the stuff he has to worry about. But let's say, I always remember, I wrote about it in my blog, about this one time I was driving by this, between Austin and Houston, taking the scenic route of 290. And about halfway there, there's a wee hamlet called Chapel Hill, about 300 people, and stop for gas. And right there, there's something called the Chapel Hill Meat Market and Cafe, which is basically a shack by the road with a smokehouse in the back. And wouldn't you notice, they sold the best brisket and jerky and sausage you ever did taste, just about. Just really fantastic meat. And we were driving up to Austin, my sister and I. And we said, well, we're having this barbecue. Let's bring our friends some meat. So we did. It was a big hit. We come back down. We said, hey, we're going back down to see our dad. Let's buy some more meat so that he can have some. So we buy him some sausage. And I was talking to the owner. This little, you got to remember, this is barely a little more than a shack in the road. It's just like nothing. And I asked the girl, the owner, I said, wow, this is really good stuff. And she goes, thank you very much. And I go, wow, you must sell a lot of it. She goes, yeah, about 1,000 pounds. And I went, really? 1,000 pounds a week? That's amazing. She goes, no, honey, every day. So we're talking about, you know, because everybody who takes that road knows that shack, you know? And so here's a lady and her husband, and they're, you know, their meat sells for about, you know, $12 a pound, and they might be making about half of that from pure profit. So they're making $6,000 a day from the shack in Texas.
Okay.
And that, so what they have beside, you know, they have to do the work, obviously, but what that allows them to do is have a lot of sovereignty over their own life, where they live, you know, what they can buy, you know. And, you know, there's not much to spend your money on in Chapel Hill, so they have all this money coming in, not a lot to spend it on. All of a sudden, you know, they have a standard of living that's really rather high, even though that all just the idea is, it's like, let's open a shack by the road on 290. But it's their idea. You see, they own that idea. They own that thing.
Okay.
I live out here in West Texas, and I write books, my little books, and I sit in my little shack, and I write books and draw cartoons and sell them. And it's not like, I'm not trying to be big like Andy Warhol. I'm just, like, wanting my own patch.
Okay. Well, you know what I really what I really like is that when you started your career of drawing on the back business cards.
Right.
I mean, you didn't imagine this to be where it is today. I mean, you didn't set out to set the world on fire. You found something you really loved to enjoy, that you enjoy doing, and you found your passion. What is your message to other people?
Find your passion and keep at it. You know, I think there's a certain kind of... I remember when I first started doing it, I just assumed it wouldn't be commercial, and I'd never make any money doing it, and they would never get well known. So there's a certain kind of deliciousness about them being obscure. I kind of enjoyed the fact that they were kind of secret almost to the world, because that way I could just do them and not really worry about it. You know? I think, how do you say? What's my message? Find something you truly love and just keep at it and don't worry about, you know, don't worry if, you know, success is not immediately forthcoming, because in my experience, you know, good ideas take a long time to kind of convert. But I think we all want a good idea. We don't want to just kind of, I mean, how many people do we know who just kind of just turn up every day and fill in forms for a living?
Mm-hmm.
That's not a good idea.
I just like that you found something that you loved to do regardless if it was going to be profitable, and you loved it because of the passion of it. And I think a lot of people need to realize to find that thing and not so much worry about the next big idea, because I think you're chasing a dream.
Right. Well, I remember something, I can't remember his name, but he's a guy who founded Celestial Seasons Tea, you know, that little tea bag company?
Yes.
They make all them kind of fancy teas. And he just said, I never want to be rich, I just love making tea.
Okay.
That makes any sense. And that, you know, and I mean, obviously when you graduate college and you don't want to wait tables your whole life, you got to go find something to do that's kind of professional, that kind of goes somewhere, not a dead-end job. But after that, I think you have to... you know, to find what you love is hard as heck, you know?
I know.
If finding what you love was easy, and then turning to money was easy, none of us would work for the post office. You know, we'd all just be, you know, running around. I think, okay.
No, I was going to say, how do you, you know, you mentioned in your book that you got to put the time in. And
right.
about luck? Does luck play in any of this?
Sure, but you know, kind of what did Louis Pasteur say? Fortune favors the prepared mind. In other words, that Jack Nicklaus saying, you know, when somebody said, "Hey, lucky putt," he went, "Yeah, the more I practice, the luckier I get." Yeah, we all have luck. We all have luck. It's just a question of how heavily do you want to rely on it. The other thing is, yeah, I have friends who are successful artists, like, you know, quite a few of them. Some of them are famous, some of them are quasi-famous, some of them make a really good living. You know, And I, you know, I kind of asked myself, okay, and some are writers, and some are filmmakers, some are painters, some are musicians, but what do they all have in common? What's the one thing they all have in common? And, okay, a wee bit of talent, okay, but that's not really it. It's what they all have in common is just this amazing, you know, titanium work ethic, if that makes any sense. And I know plenty of people who are just as talented who aren't successful, but they sleep till noon, and they go to the bars. And they're trying to wing it on their talent.
Yeah.
So the great art critic Robert Hughes once said he had this great phrase for success for artists, which is talent, discipline, and stamina.
Okay.
So you have to have the talent, and you have to work it, and then you have to do it for a long time. Now we have this kind of reality TV show thing going on, where people are not particularly talented or not particularly good at anything, they could become overnight famous. Well, they're lucky. And it's kind of luck or kind of a mad being the right time, the right place. But that can all be taken away from them. You know, the public is very fickle, you know. They'll just find somebody else to replace them once they get bored. Whereas, and people like that story because it's, people like those kind of rags to riches stories.
I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Hugh, I'm sorry. There you go. We couldn't hear you that well.
Okay.
So that's just luck.
People like those easy stories because they think, hey, I could be lucky too. But then, go to Vegas. You know, but don't complain when you come back without your wedding ring that you pawned. You know?
Hey. Here, tell me about I love this part about the sex and cash theory.
Ah, yes. Yes. Well, it's that's been my experience. The quote unquote creative life has two parts: the sexy creative kind, you know, the rock star kind, and then the I call it the sex part, and then you have the cash part, which is just doing stuff to pay the bills. For example, I can draw all day, and that's pretty sexy. But at the same time, I've got to, like, the cash part is, you know, I have to worry about invoices and shipping and customers and marketing and accounting and, you know, a lot of stuff I'd rather not do. But that's never going to go away. And it's not just you know, the typical young artist who's working on his novel and has to wait tables. So that's sex and cash, you know, writing by day, waiting tables by night. And the thing about the sex and cash theory, actually, that will never stop once you become a famous movie star, because you're still going to need the money. So you're still going to do interesting films occasionally with Woody Allen or Tarantino to create credibility. But, you know, you, like John Travolta, you might want to buy a new airplane or a new house. Or Steve Martin wants to buy a new Henry Matisse, and so you just take the money and appear in some forgettable movie. And as an artist, once you accept the fact that a lot of your life is not just going to be about you being an artist, but you just having to roll up your sleeves and schlep. And once you let go of that kind of glamorous vision and just understand that even if you're an artist, most of your work is actual work. Then your career goes ahead much faster. This tense duality between the sex and the cash parts will never be transcended.
You see, I really like that because that's the truth, and a lot of people don't realize that. They think, you know, if you're higher up in that food chain, the less cash you have to go after. But at the end of the day, it's always some stuff that's going to be really stuff that you really enjoy, and there's going to be stuff that just pays the bills. I don't care what you do.
And there's, you know, I mean, like Bill Gates, I mean, you know, how much time, he's not working so much anymore, but, you know, how much time is going to meetings and how much time is writing code and thinking theoretical stuff?
Sure. I got one last question for you, Hugh.
Okay.
All right, and I think this is really important. How can you protect your freedom? I mean, once you get there, once you've done all this, what do you do to protect it?
Well, I'm not sure my way works for everybody, but my way has always been to remain living frugally.
Repeat that again here. I can't hear it.
Remain frugal.
Got it.
I remember once seeing the CEO of Marriott, the hotel chain, a guy about 50 years old, part of the Marriott family. And he's saying, you know, he still lives in the same house he got married in, you know, or when he got married. And, I mean, I make, let's say, a lot more money than I made, you know, 2 years ago, let's say. But I haven't bought a new car. I still live in the same place. I haven't really changed my basic habits. And I had decided that all of a sudden I want an entourage. I want a big condo in Miami. And I want a jet set over to Saint-Tropez in the summertime. Then all of a sudden, that machine would need to be fed. You know, that beast would need to be fed. And I think that's what happens to people. They you know, once they get the corner office, they think they deserve a new Lexus, even though their Honda was doing fine. And once you buy into that, then, you know, it's time to get back on the treadmill and feed the machine.
How did you come to that wisdom, Hugh? And how did you know that?
I guess there was a period of my life when my advertising career was doing pretty well back in the old days, and so I bought some stuff, and I didn't notice myself being materially life changing for the better in any kind of particular way. I just noticed being in more hawk to the man than I was before. I didn't like that feeling. Yeah, I got a friend who lives in London, and he's a pretty successful film director, and he wants to move out here in West Texas for no other reason. Well, to pay for living in London, to pay his you know, his school fees and his mortgage and, you know, his fancy restaurants, he has to make a film a year, one film per year, which is a lot of work. And he said, well, if I move out here and I like it, I only have to make one film every 3 or 4 years, which means I can put more time into it, not rush it, and not also have the gun to my head. Mm-hmm. I've never been particularly materialistic, so.
Okay. I think it's just smart, and I believe the same thing, that to protect that freedom. You live, everything goes up, comes down, and you just have to be kind of neutral to it and say, look, don't get caught into the trap of all that, because I think at the end of the day, I don't know if it brings any more happiness. I think it brings you more problems is what it does.
Yeah, but also I think this probably happens to younger people more, but it's like they lose their job and they realize they don't have enough money for next month's rent, but they've been spending it all on whatever, designer furniture. Whereas, I don't know, I run my business where the phone doesn't ring for 3 months, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Because no, seriously. No, you know, no. I've got enough work.
School.
Yeah, I've got enough work in the next year to keep me busy. I've got enough work on my plate, paid work, that's going to last me a year. Mm-hmm. You know, so. Whereas, you know, if you're only living paycheck to paycheck, well, nothing wrong with living paycheck to paycheck, but for God's sake, save as much money as you can, because, you know, one day they'll do layoffs and you'll be stuck.
Yep.
You know, I think, protecting frugality is such an underrated virtue,
mm-hmm.
especially in the consumer's world of ours, so. But.
Hey Hugh, we've got to end this. I want to thank you very much, and I'll give you a heads up when the article goes up on All Business.
Okay.
And give me, you know, what if anything goes on in your life, anything interesting, you write another book, let us know, would you?
All righty. Well, you know, follow me on Twitter or my blog.
Okay.
I have a new book coming out in a year called Evil Plans, and I started writing a third book.
I love that title.
Yeah,
who comes
like
out with your titles?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you want to read about it, go to gapingvoid.com/EP, as an Evil Plans EP.
Okay.
Cool.
Evil Plans. I love it.
Yeah.
Hugh, thank you. I've enjoyed this very much.